Accession number 16692, reel 2.
It's a reeve reel 2.
Right. So having Sitsi, Sergeant Stripes on, we went on the wings parade and had our wings presented, and all the Canadian chaps got commissions, but only five of the RAF, and that was the first five in the ground school. And I was fifth in the ground school, so I was told I got a commission. So you took your sergeant stripes on and put a white band on. So I was an LAC in the morning, sergeant at lunchtime, and a pilot officer at tea time. Quite incredible. So then all the posting came through, and I wanted to go on to flying boats, and I wanted to go down to Pensacola in America to learn to fly Catalinas and eventually Sunderlands. But all the posting came through except 18, and the concert party had a show booked at the local town in a fortnight's time, and the group captain wouldn't allow us to go, said those people on the concert party got to stay and do the concert party and take the next lot of postings, which we did, and the next lot of posting was on to fighters. And that's how it was selected. And so at the end of the Harvard course was going to be posted to French Canada, a place called Bagotville, where there was a hurricane operational training unit. Interesting thing, though, everybody's mad to get their officer's uniform when you're first commissioned, and you go on leave, and there's a chap in Toronto called Bullock that ran an outfitter's shop, but he guaranteed if you walked in his shop, you could walk out with a uniform on, and you're always allowed two, and then he'd make a tailor-made one for you and send it on later, which we all did. So eventually, after a lot of... I had a fortnight in leave in New York, where in one of my speeches I tell them how I saw Frank Sinatra hit by eggs from someone in the audience at the Roxy Cinema at the time that he was attracting all the bobby soxers, and they were screaming about some chap the audience didn't like that and threw eggs at him and hit him in the face and the band, and there was absolutely pandemonium. They played the national anthem, they had the mounted police out. My friend and I were up in the balcony because we couldn't get down, and we laughed like drains at all this, and all the girls turned on us because they couldn't get to the bloke down there, and we had to be escorted out by the mounted police into Broadway. Not many people. And funnily enough, recently there's been a program on Frank Sinatra's life where the actors played the part, and they did actually bring this egg throwing bit into it, which I was quite surprised. And so I said, well, I was there. But then we went to Bagotville in French Canada to go on to hurricanes. Well, all through fighter careers until the modern times, you never had a dual-control fighter for someone to take you up and show you how to do it. You just had to go up the first time yourself. And this happened even on Jets and Tempest 2s, which is quite a thing. But we went on to hurricanes, found them very nice to play, to fly. They were Packard Merlins on them, which we used to laughingly say were always packing up. But we did very good course there. We did rocket firing and so forth like that, which was the standards instead in the future. After that, we had to come home. So I was sent to a transit camp with all my pals to wait to come across the Atlantic. Another strange thing happened to me. In the middle of the night, someone came in, called my name out and said, get down to the docks, you're going back on the Mauritania. Only me, nobody else. And so I went and was sent back on the Mauritania, which is a sort of a scaled down version of the Queen Elizabeth II. No, the Queen Elizabeth, not the second, Queen Elizabeth, the first Queen Elizabeth. I went over on the Queen Mary, this is the Queen Elizabeth, and there's a scaled down model of that, really. And it was so crowded, although we were officers, we had probably a dozen to a little cabin, and even the sergeants slept on the open deck. And they had a lot of Canadian women soldiers, or racks, or whatever they were, coming back on it. Anyhow, fairly uneventful across the Atlantic, they sped across again. But this time we docked at Liverpool. And we came into Liverpool, and the winds were wrong, and he couldn't dock, so the captain had to turn around and go back. And we cruised up and down the Irish Sea at night, which is a dangerous thing to do, I think. Went the next day, he still couldn't get in. And this happened about 4 days, by which time everyone was roundly booing the captain every time he turned round. Food was going off. Went to have highly curried fish to take away the taste. The water was getting brown. We weren't allowed up on decks because of the blackout. And there was almost a revolution taking place. So eventually they allowed us up on decks while we were in the Irish Sea. And of course all the Canadian women went up there as well, and so the RAF, so some great hijinks went on at that time. But at last he got into Liverpool. So then from Liverpool we were taken to Harrogate, which is a reception centre, one of the hotels there, and I was sent home on leave. It was the first time I'd been home on leave except for once in probably 18 months, I suppose. When I joined up as a sort of a young lad of 18, one expects to come home on leave quite quickly, but I came home after about 6 weeks because my father was very seriously ill. When I was in this initial training wing in Scarborough, I'm going back a bit now just to say why I was on leave the first time, and I had to come back. This is before I went into grading school. I'm probably going out of sequence now, but it's an interesting point. We were in Scarborough, what they call initial training wing, after leaving the aircrew receiving centre in London, was ground school and drill, playing football on the beach in middle of winter. My father had burst ulcers, and they sent for me because he wasn't going to survive. When I got home, the doctor said, well, we've given him several blood transfusions, no good, but you look pretty fit, how about giving him one, you see? So I said, okay. And he took my blood, he said, good gracious, it's blue. I said, well, that's the sea air and things of Scarborough. And you know, to cut a long story short, they gave him to my father, the next day he was up and about, and he survived from then on. But it was the only time I got home on leave, until after coming back from Canada, I went home on leave just at Christmas again. By which time, as I said, I got my wings and commission, which I was 19 when I got those. I was 19. And I've got the commissioning certificate here in the house now. So, a quick leave home, a telegram, had to go back to Millfield in Northumberland to an operational training unit on Typhoons and Tempest Fives, where we learned to fly those. Again, there's no dual, so you got the first time yourself. And we did a lot of rocket practice. I also flew Tempest Fives in a sort of fighter wing cover system.
What was it like flying the Tempest and the Typhoon?
Well, it's quite amazing. It's a good job it was a Hawker, because we'd been flying Hurricanes. So it's an updated, very uprated thing, but some of the things were very similar. So it wasn't quite so bad, but it was a bit frightening at the time, because we had a Napier Sabre engine, whereas in the Hurricane and the Spitfire, for instance, had the Merlins, you know, but Napier Sabre engines, which were a little bit dicey at the time, they were about 2,500 horsepower, and they had a tendency to cut out. But once you got used to them, it was quite nice playing to play. Until, again, reading a book 45 years later, which talked about Typhoons, said there were terrible planes to fly, and only specialised pilots could fly them, and to be posted to a Typhoon squadron was like receiving a sentence of death, because they lost so many, as they did in the early on. Anyhow, I was destined for a Typhoon squadron, not knowing that they were supposed to be hard to fly. We were just told to do it, and that was it. And I didn't realise that their losses were so great as they were.
Did you find them hard to fly?
No, not at all. Look, once you got the first solo over, I found it quite straightforward, really. And the Tempest 5, which was a derivative of the Typhoon, but with a swept-back wing, like a Spitfire's, elliptical wing, that's the word, was very much the same, only faster, because it became the plane that got all the flying bombs down later on, as you know. But I only flew those in training, and some of the people from the course went on to Tempest 5 squadrons where they were had the full fighter role, and I went on to the rocket firing Typhoon squadrons where we were close support for the army and ground attack all the time. So having left Millfield, I was suddenly sent to somewhere near Surrey, Godalming, somewhere near there, and taken on an Anson, and I joined 137 squadron at Helmond in Holland, which was just beyond Eindhoven. So I was quite late really, but we were stationed in one of these aerodromes they built with mesh, you know, the mesh sort of runway and that sort of thing. But there was a building there which was like a training home for monks, and they'd taken that over. The monks still lived in the top floor, but we lived in there, the officers' mess was, and we actually slept in the cubicles that the monks used to sleep in. And we had great times in the mess, and somebody brought some of the monks down and gave them a few beers, etc. like that. But they looked after us very well. We lived on McConaughey's tin food most of the time, as you did in 2nd Taft, that was, 2nd Tactical Air Force. But in Helmond, and a bit later on, they used to give us a lot of Horlicks tablets, and at Helmond they gave us oysters as well, which was rather amazing in the evening. Oysters and Horlicks tablets. And so there I started my operations.
Do you remember your first operation?
Yeah, I do, very much so. Because, and then there's another strange thing, things that happened to me. But the first operation, you fly as number 4 to a number 3. And as I say in one of my talks, in those days you flew as a finger 4 formation when there's 4 of you. The leader was the number 1 there. His number 2 was the next one beside him, and he protected him in that area. The number 3 was the second in command, and his number 4 protected him all around that side. And I flew as number 4 to a chap called Dick Edgeley, who was a Aussie, and who took me on the first operation. And Dick Edgeley was hit by flak and crash landed. And I saw him land, and I saw him get out of the plane and wave to me, or wave to all of us, in fact. But unfortunately, the Typhoon was so terrifying to the Germans. You imagine 8 rockets coming at you. That they used to hate the Typhoon pilots, and there was a tendency, if any of them were captured, for them to be lynched. Now, Dick Edgeley was quite safe when I saw him. We never heard of him again. Many years later, I was in the bank at Cambridge, and I was on the counter, and someone came and said, "There's 2 people in Australia want to see you." And they came along, and it was Dick Edgeley's mother and father. And they had been trying to trace what happened to him. And as I was the last one to see him, they asked me what I could tell them about it. So I had to say, well, he was shot down. I think he must have got killed in the crash. I didn't like to say that I'd seen him get out, because I'm sure he must have been killed by either German troops or the local people. I didn't want to tell his parents that. So I said, no, I was with him, and we got shot down, and I was too busy with doing what I was supposed to do to see what happened to him in the end. So I assumed he must have died in the crash, you know. I thought it best to say that rather than what I suspected, because he done or did get out, and I saw him. But the fact that he never came back again just proves to me that he was put to death one way or another, either by the local populace or by the Gestapo or SS or who happened to be around. But it was very, very tragic. Of course, at that time I didn't know that it happened, and I know I saw him get out of the aircraft, as I said, but I mean, it wasn't until way after the war that no one ever heard of him again. I realised it must have happened. And then when his parents came in to see me, I knew it must have happened then, because he never came back in any way.
What was the date of this operation?
What date?
You said it must be around about March 23rd.
Yeah, something in that period. That's right. That's when I started my operations, and the first two on there. I didn't write in my book that he had gone down on that. I probably thought it best not to, I suppose. But then after that, we were.
What were you supposed to be doing on that operation?
A lot of the time, we're attacking the German ground troops in there, their gunners and places like that. But one of the big things we did from Helmand was called a Munster Milk Run. There used to be a train going out of Munster the same time every day, and we used to go and attack this train. I don't know what was supposed to be on it or anything like that, but it got known as the Munster Milk Run. My book says armed recce Munster attacked the train west of Munster and blew trucks up. For some unknown reason, we had to keep doing that. But before then, of course, the big thing was the Rhine crossing, which was on the 25th of March. Now, before the Rhine crossing, General Montgomery used to be famous for telling all his troops what they were going to do the next day or what they were going to do in the battle. And it so happened that he made it happen to us, that we had to be told what was going to happen. So our wing commander, who was called Kit North Lewis, Wing Command Kit North Lewis, had us all that night to say, tomorrow will be Rhine crossing. And we used to fly across to the Germans at 8,000 feet. And we had to dive to attack a gun or troop emplacement, even a church sometimes, we had to knock the top off. We attacked a lot of transport on the road. An awful lot of horse-drawn transport, which we hated, because you could see the horses being blown to bits and all that sort of thing, you know. But the Germans used an awful lot of that at that particular time, and they were pulling back, because obviously when we got to the Rhine and that sort of area, they were on the retreat and they were pulling back. We used to go and attack them on this sort of on these sort of operations. But we all flew over 8,000 feet because the German 88mm anti-aircraft fire was the most accurate in the world. And if you flew along and you stayed in one position for 4 seconds, they had you. So you had to weave the whole time. And it was quite frightening. As you weaved, the shell had burst where you were a few seconds before. 8,000 feet was considered the safest you could go. When you attacked a target, you had to dive down at an angle approaching 60 degrees, you're supposed to dive down. Now, we never had special gun sights for the rockets. You had the ordinary gun sight. Now, a rocket fell away after it's fired. It's a fascinating thing to see a rocket fired, because they're held under the wings and they're basically cordite all the way through, and they're electrically operated. You press the button and they're released, and you see them flying alongside you for a few seconds before suddenly... the cordite catches, and they go at a tremendous pace then to where the target is. But with the weight of the nose of the rockets, there has a big lot of bullet drop, as you'd call it, in a rifle. So you had to allow for all this on the gun sight. What we had to do, we had to estimate the angle of dive, estimate your speed, your ground speed, which you could work out mainly from your airspeed at that particular time, and do a sort of little trigonometry sum and allow so many rings of the gun side up, which would bring you so you could do it. And that all happening when you're diving down. Well, when you're diving down to a target, the gunners have a marvellous chance, because they've only got to shoot up straight at you. You're not weaving then. And that's how so many targets got lost, by being shot down by flak. And they were very, very good, the German flak gunners. Very, very good indeed. And so that was a great problem. We went at 8,000 feet. Our biggest risk was diving down. The night before the Rhine crossing, we were told we got to go over at 2,000 feet, draw the flak off the gliders, the Dakotas, and everything, the Americans, everybody who was going across to drop parachutists over the Rhine, everybody who was going to land gliders over the Rhine. We got to go across at 2,000 feet and draw the flak off. Of course, everybody was horrified at that. And a mad rush for the bar. And Wing Commander Kit North Lewis said, "That's all right, boys, I'll lead the first operation in the morning." And so he did. And as I say in one of my speeches, he's the first one shot down. But I didn't know the full story. What I say in my speech is slightly different to what's appeared in that book. But he landed on an island in the Rhine called Wesel, and the whole of the German garrison gave themselves up to him. And he sort of marched them back and got them to surrender, and he got the DSO for it. And it's covered in that book as well. But so that was what, so we had to go. And my biggest memory of the Rhine crossing is that the smoke everywhere. They put down so many smoke shells that you really couldn't see the ground or the target. You could feel yourself being fired at as we're trying to draw the flak off these people. And then, of course, once the troops had got across, the thing all quietened down again. And we used to attack the tanks in the wood. Ah, that's an interesting thing. We used to do what they call red smoke jobs. I don't know if anyone's told you about that before, but in the early days, I don't think they did. But at this particular time, tanks were retreating, German tanks and so forth, and then they were holding up our troops' advance, and they'd be sort of hidden in a wood somewhere, and they couldn't get them out. And the army used to ring us up and said, "Can you attack this certain wood? Be over the target, so we say 12 o'clock. We will put red smoke shells down in the wood. And you fire your rockets into those red smoke shells and come home," which we did several times. Never saw a thing. But every time we got back, they said, "Jolly good show, you knocked them all out." But it was the red smoke jobs, as they came to be known. And we had very close cooperation with the army at that particular time. There had been times in the past when, you know, a little bit at odds with them, but we were very close with them then. We also continued to attack the trains, and if we could find a train any time, and the Germans got a bit crafty, they started putting aircraft, anti-aircraft guns on trucks in the trains, covered by tarpaulins, you know. And you're going to attack an innocent-looking train, and suddenly all hell is let loose at you as they open up at you. That was quite exciting. And they also used to... What happened with us, the Typhoon had a great big wing gun bay. The wing route was very thick. And we used to move forward from various fields as the army captured a field, an aerodrome, shall we say. And we'd be told to move forward to that field where it'd be our next base. And sometimes it happened while we're in the air. And they say, "Don't go back to your old base, go to a new one, so and so." So we took the habit of packing our bedding and certain personal kit in the gun bay so that we'd have it when we got to those fields. The Germans got a bit crafty about that. They used to get some sort of chap on their radio who spoke like our controller, and told us to go to some other place where, if they landed, they would be... they capture 8 or 9 aircraft all of a sudden. That happened to me nearly once, because the system we used to have was, if there was 8 aircraft going in operation, 9 would take off, 1 being the spare, in case any of the others developed engine trouble and couldn't continue. And I was the last one on an operation, which is actually, they were all sergeant pilots running this, and one of the aircraft failed to take off, so I had to go along as the tail ender on this thing. And coming back, they were directed to an aerodrome, and being at the end, I was more chance to look around. I saw a Focke-Wulf 190 parked on this thing at aerodrome. So I had to yell to the leader, you know, "For goodness sake, come away from there," in words of similar vein. And we did, and they opened up on us pretty fiercely. But when we took over the German aerodromes later on, because they knew them, that was their bases, so they'd come back at night and bomb us, because they knew the whole thing. And in some cases, one or two cases, they poisoned all the water before they left. And I can remember the occasion when we actually washed and shaved in beer and drank it as well, of course, till they got some water supplies in. But they did actually poison the water. Now, I haven't seen that in any of those books there, but I know it happened because I was in one of the stations where it did. And so, obviously, we carried on and on to Holland and then to Germany. I went to a place called the whole wing went to a place called Enschede in Holland. Then we had the Elbe crossing. I went to a new place called Rhine in Germany, then Hanover. Still doing all these attacks on tanks and motor transport and guns and things like that. Eventually did Lübeck, Lüneburg, Celle. And then I've got a note here on the date of that, May the 4th, which is a different date, as you'll appreciate, to what we say now. Note there, Jerry's capitulate, I guess war is over. That was May the 4th. So they actually surrendered on that, but the signing wasn't done until the 8th, I think, was it? May the 8th, something like that, yeah.
Do any of those operations stick out in your mind as individual operations?
relating to me personally.
Yes.
There was one, two really. One was, and I can't really tell you categorically what it was, but it was a wing operation where that squadron and the rest of us were involved. We'd been told that some chateau was a Gestapo headquarters. And it was late information coming in, and we went out and in dusk, because we never did any night flying, it was dangerous, you know. So we went out at dusk to do this, and it was led by John Derry, who was later killed at Farnborough in the DH-110, if you remember that, when it broke up at Farnborough in peacetime. And yeah, we went and tacked this thing, and then afterwards, the next day, we found out that it wasn't the Gestapo headquarters. I think it was a Danish consul's and killed all his family and everything. And everybody was most upset about that, obviously. And we went out to see it and reinforced our views about these things. But the one that stuck out my memory more, I can't remember when it was, I came back and I had a new aircraft, and the sergeant mechanic said, you've got a 28 mil through the main spar. There's only a quarter of an inch of the main spar left. We used to come back and do a terrific peel off fancy thing for the rest of the aerodrome and dive down like that. One of the COs said, you're not to do that, you may have damage you don't know. And how right he was, because if I'd done that, that wing would have come off, instead of which it landed quite well. But the one which does stick in my mind, we attacked Hamburg when the Germans were trying to escape, and some of the top brass are trying to escape in ships, and we attacked all these ships in Hamburg harbour, and we dived down through cloud, and I don't really remember the result of the operation, but I pulled up and I was on my own. I had an Aussie as my number two, and he'd lost me, and I'd lost the rest of the squadron. We all got separated, and not being one of the leaders then, I didn't have maps or anything or courses, so I steered what we knew as we called a safety course, which will get us near home. And I was attacked by six Spitfires, because I don't know if you know, but even in the early days of the Typhoon, some of the top Typhoon aces were shot down by our own aircraft, because the big scoop of the Typhoon made it look like a Focke-Wulf 190, the big air scoop, and there were no end of Typhoon pilots shot down by our own aircraft, sometimes some of the greatest aces on Typhoons. So these Spitfires obviously thought, on my own, I was a Focke-Wulf 190.